So here I am, Randall Tonks, in Santiago, Cuba, at the University de Oriente, with Professor.
My name's Vicente Ricalo. I've been working at this university since 1988, and I've begun to work in the major in 1995 when I began to teach translation and interpretation. And I've also taught terminology and phonetics, and also English grammar, which I just started to teach to the second students students of the English major. I can also say that last October I got my master's degree in nonverbal communication, my focus being the nonverbal communication and its importance in the communication between Cubans and Jamaicans.
Thank you, Professor Ricalo. So what I'd like to know a little bit more about is the program that you are currently teaching in here and preparing students for practical work experience in translation. So perhaps you could tell a little bit about the program and what your role is here as part of that program.
So you want to know specifically about translation and interpretation, don't you? Okay, the students here began to receive translation in second year, and they started to receive interpreting in third year. Up to both of them, up to the fifth year when they graduate. The program focuses on translation from English into Spanish, but we, the teachers who work in this discipline, in our lessons, we also incorporate chunks of text in which the students have also to translate and interpret from Spanish into English, because when they graduate, they have to do it both ways. So this is a difficulty that we try to face. That we try to solve in our lessons, even though the program, the syllabus, does not address, the translation from Spanish into English. As it is well known, interpreting, because of the things which are involved in this process, turns to be more difficult for the students than translation is. I think you have witnessed this in your in all this time that you have been here with our students. Short-term memory, this is something that affects them very much. I've even been trying to make a work together with some teachers of the psychology department, but the matter is we have no time because we are so much involved in our lessons and also in our research. I'm also now involved in my PhD degree, which I'm supposed to defend by 2005. But I think that doing a serious research paper with a psychology department could be a palliative, for the short-term memory. Also the concentration, this is also which affects our students very much. And there is something that they also cite as a stumbling block at the time of interpreting, and that also puts them very tense. That makes them very tense, maybe they need a little more contact with native speakers, and also with native speakers from the United States, from Canada, and even from the English speaking Caribbean, which is something that has been demonstrated that we have no recordings from English Caribbean speakers here in our major. Professor Carlos Labrada and I, about 3 years ago, we worked in the Expo Caribe Trade Fair as interpreters, and we ourselves noticed that at times it was hard for us to understand these people, despite the fact that I've been working with Jamaican people for a while. So we decided to begin to bring our recordings from this area, from this geographical area, to our classes. But so far, we haven't done this. So I don't think if you have any. I don't think, first of all, if I have answered this first question. If not, you let me know, and I'll say something else.
Sure. Okay. So you've actually jumped ahead to some of the other questions, which is great, and we can get into more detail there. But so clearly, what you're doing is preparing the students for careers in translation or interpretation as part of this, and there are a number of tasks and aspects that are challenging for them that you have to work on as part of your teaching in this.
Yes, we have to be clear, and we have to bear in mind that translation is such a difficult task. And when I say translation, I'm involved in both translating and interpreting. That I think in maybe in no other job, this statement that we say in Cuba, that no knowledge is heavy. Maybe you get my point. What I mean is that whatever you learn is going to be good for you. And I think in any maybe in any sphere, this statement is not going to be as valid as in translation, because whatever they learn, they never know what they are going to face. They never know what topic they are going to deal with. And this also becomes a stumbling block because our students lack culture. Our students, and I think it is, something worldwide. I think the youth is somehow reluctant to read, and we try to make up. I mean, we professors, we try to make up for this by bringing texts to class concerning the culture of the different peoples of the world, because we think this is very, very, very important. And in this on-the-job training, they have realized that things that we had dealt with in class, they have dealt with, and it was a good thing that we had already dealt with some things in class that when they come to work with you, they already knew, not because they had read, but because we had them do bibliographical work, encyclopedia work, before dealing with a certain topic. For example, some classes ago we dealt with the Arabic countries and also with the Muslim countries, so they had to do a bibliographical work and they had to present that in class so everybody could know about it, so everybody could interchange about it. And I think now that I'm teaching English grammar for the first time, and I can tell you that I'm teaching English grammar, trying to address some things in English grammar that I have realized because of my experience in dealing with translation, that the students should know that we should focus on when teaching English grammar. For example, yesterday, there was an examination and translation, and there were two sentences in which a contact clause, as the English grammar calls it, a contact clause, that is that adjective clause when the relative that is omitted. And my students, fourth year, it was hard for them to, and they asked me, Professor, no missing element here, no comma, no period. And I told them, no, if you read it properly, you'll realize it is a type of complex sentence that the English grammar calls contact close. And now I'm focusing in English grammar that I'm teaching now, I repeat, on all of these things that when the students come to deal with translation, with more difficult texts in translation in the years to come, so might be troublesome for them. And translation and interpretation is, we say, the leading discipline of our program, so every other subject contributes to our students' training in this discipline. Something that I've also worked with, I even presented a paper on this in a symposium, has to do with fluency. Fluency at the time of speaking, but also fluency and some things related to fluency. For example, the native speakers of English used so phonetic changes as elision, assimilation, dissimilation. And our students, when they receive phonetics and phonology, they are never talked about these changes. So they deal with so much formal English that many times when they come to talk with a native speaker, and the native speaker use their colloquial variant, which is not vulgar by any means, they do not understand. They can't understand what the native speakers say to them. So I think we are doing some research works in the department, which hopefully all of them together will find a way, you know, to improve the work of every subject, and consequently the students' mastery, the students' competence in translation and interpretation.
Thank you. No, I think you've really touched on a number of the issues that I'm moving towards here as well. And with respect to the issue of culture and understanding of the history and the broader aspects outside of the task of translation, this is something that clearly I see in my classes as well, that a lot of students aren't really interested in. A lot of students aren't terribly interested in the deeper historical and cultural aspects behind the material that we learn in the classroom, I find, and that many of them are very much focused on the task at hand and don't care so much about where ideas come from and what the broader historical or philosophical background is. But clearly, I think, as you've identified, that in the task of translation, that there is this other issue at hand of cultural competence, where they have to understand the cultures with which they're dealing with, to understand the words, the colloquial sayings, and so on. Which is precisely what my next question is for you, is the issue around expressions or colloquial words that are not part of, as you say, the formal language. I know in my own experience in traveling across Canada to Quebec and having learned French in school in a very formal Parisian style, when I moved to Montreal and moved around in Quebec, I found that the expressions used were completely meaningless to me. I had no understanding of them. So how do you prepare students for translation and understanding of local expressions in from various cultures?
Well, this is something really difficult to deal with. For example, in my translation classes, many times I when I give my students a text, I on purpose leave some blank spaces, you know, so as to force them to infer by meaning, sorry, by the context, what is logical to fill in that blank space. And I tell them, I don't care so much about you filling with the right expression or with the right word, because what I want you to do is to be logical, and according to the context you follow something that makes sense, and this is a procedure that I've read nowhere, but it occurred to me that this way I could help them infer by context. Apart from this, I also did a research work, which I also present in a symposium, and it has to do with phrases. I didn't call it proverbs, I just call it phraseological units, because I think it is a more encompassive term, because I include proverbs, and I also include other phrases as well. And here, the way I present, it is a glossary. And the way I present these phraseological units, I do it from Spanish into English, and I do it by topics. For example, absence makes the heart grow fonder. I didn't include this phrase into the topic of love, but into the topic of maybe memory or maybe absence, you know, so that when the students feel the need to find a given phrase, a given phraseological unit in English, they go to the topic, because the topic is going to state the essence of the phraseological unit, so they go into that glossary and they can, you know, and so one of my aims is to have this, to have the students use, the teachers use this glossary in their lessons. Not only the translation and interpretation teachers, but also from the very beginning when they deal with the so-called integrated English practice, they can use this glossary, you know. And so this is a way I try to help my students in dealing with this topic, which is so difficult, which is so difficult because, for example, me myself, I was brought up by my mother, and my mother is very fond of proverbs and so on, but I found that many people do not know even proverbs which are widely known in our community. So it is also a matter of, I don't know, it is a matter of bringing up. It is a matter of education. It is a matter of who you were, so who brought you up. Yes. But if you're going to be a professional, if you're going to be a translator or an interpreter, no matter how or who brought you up, you have to learn. You know, you have to develop a linguistic sensitivity for phraseological units. Yes. That's a fact.
Yes. Absolutely. Thank you. The next question is one that you've touched on already in terms of some of the special challenges that students face, and this is the issue of context. And on our tour here, we've been to various contexts. We've been to a medical familia, we've been to museums, we've been to cultural centers, and so on. How do you find that in preparing the students, or how do you prepare the students to be able to go to these various contexts where there may be very specific and particular language used? For example, say in a legal setting or in a medical setting, there may be very special terms that are going to be used. How do you prepare them? Because obviously, as you've identified, the wealth of knowledge that these students must draw upon is huge. And in a mere 4 years or 2.5, 3 years, to prepare them must be a very difficult task.
Well, as I told you, this is something that is done long before they begin to receive translation, because from the very beginning in integrated English practice, also in a subject that is called cultura cubana, Cuban culture, and in many other subjects, they have to do a lot of bibliographical work. And we address a great assortment of topics that they are so likely to deal with when students, and also when they graduate. So in translation, I told you already, before we deal with a certain text, we have our students go to the library, or go to internet and also get familiar with the topic we're going to deal with. And I can include here, I told you already the Muslim countries and the Arabic countries, but also sports, economics, commerce, politics, which is something that that even though we avoid talking about, we always have to adopt a political stance, and we always have to, I mean, we'll always have to deal with politics at some point in our job. For example, in the text, in the examination I already told you about, it was yesterday, there is a part of the text which speaks about the rogue states. And as rogue states, they refer to Iraq, they refer to Syria, they refer to Libya. And when they look up in the dictionaries that we have here in Cuba, the meanings that are given for the word rogue do not fit the sense of the word rogue in that context. So by the abilities they have developed already, I told you before, by giving them blank spaces and so on, they had to infer. That was the only way for them to infer the meaning of rogue. And they had to think a lot. So, and they have to, I mean, read the text, read it over, so as to try to infer the meaning of rogue. Maybe they won't all infer the right sense of the word rogue, but they try. And this process of searching is very, very important for me, because an examination is just an examination. So when we come to discuss it, we do sort of a brainstorm, and then I tell them, this is the right sense of this word here. You made it, you got close to make it, or you didn't make it. Yeah. But that's the way, you know? Yeah. And in translation, they feel less embarrassed because they don't feel so judged by the public. In interpreting, they could be even better. And I tell them to read the famous essay Self-Reliance by Ralph Waldo Emerson, because I try to, I say, to inject them that self-reliance which is so necessary in this job.
I appreciate that, and in fact, just on Friday when we visited Castillo del Moro, one of your students had been reading an article from, I believe, an American magazine talking about the politics, and he asked me about the phrases slam dunk and jump ball being referred to in politics, and I think that's certainly something I know the Americans like to use sports metaphors to talk a lot about politics and other aspects of their culture. So I greatly appreciate the work that he was doing to understand those strange terms in the political sphere. Last couple of questions are rather related. First of all, with respect to the students, and then finally to your own work, can you tell me a little bit more about nonverbal behavior in the translation process, so that when you are preparing students, for example, to interpret on a tour or with other foreigners, there may be nonverbal cues that are present within a certain culture that convey a good deal of meaning, and how do you prepare students to be aware of some of these kinds of things to help get the correct meaning in translation?
Well, unfortunately, I could tell you that we cannot speak currently about a nonverbal training in our lessons. First of all, because it is not included in the program at all, I always quote a very outstanding Cuban intellectual who lived in the 19th century, Enrique José Varona, and he said that both syllabuses and examinations were an enemy of learning. Because he said, what is a syllabus? A syllabus is a number of lessons, a number of hours, no hour less, no hour more, and it confines the teacher many times. So I quite agree with him. And I don't think it will be so easy to persuade my colleagues to use nonverbal in their lessons. So I think it is me. I think if it is me, the one who is working on this, who did it in the master's degree, and who also supposed to do it in the PhD degree, it is me who has to face this in classes. And I told you it was last October that I defending my master's, so I will think seriously to begin implementing this in classes by next September. Because what I've done so far is not something planned, you know? It is something that is really done in passing, you know? And when we come to see something that is recurrent and that kind of a communication, we do it, but nothing planned as yet, unfortunately.
Good morning. Sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
Ana Lilia wants you to give her...
That we'll have to do it with Jamaican people, which is the focus of my thesis. We'll also have to do it with Canadian people, and I think that this Canadian Studies chair that we have in our department is going to give me the chance to do it with Canadian people. I've already talked to Barbara Coso, the president of this chair, about it. I told her that it is going to be my research line in this Canadian Studies chair. We'll also have to do it at some point, I mean, in our classes, but as something planned with the British people, differences, nonverbal differences between Cubans and British people, and also with the cultures that have often contacts with us.
So, thank you. So the final question is, can you tell me a little bit about your own research that you've been doing with nonverbal behavior between Cubans and Jamaicans?
Yeah. What moved me into this was I always thought that no matter how close we are geographically, if they speak English and we speak Spanish, there should be important nonverbal differences between Jamaicans and Cubans. No matter that we both are very unpunctual, there should be important nonverbal differences. I should say that when I say nonverbal, I'm not referring just to body movement. I'm also referring to the management of time. Mm-hmm. I mean degree of punctuality. I'm also referring to chronemics. Chronemics is the time that elapses between my turn in speaking and your turn in speaking. I'm also referring to the speed in speaking and to the volume in speaking. So there are so many nonverbal variables that can affect communication that I for my PhD, I was advised to reduce because I can't deal with all of them. So I'm thinking, even though in my master's, I try to touch all of them. For my PhD, I have to, and I'm just thinking. So I have to give some interviews to people who have been to Jamaica, so as to throw light on what variables, on which variables were the ones that had a greater impact, I mean, in their communication with Jamaican people. This is something, I think it's fascinating, mm-hmm. and I think it's very important, because the communication with the English Caribbean people is increasing more and more. For example, I can tell you that we have a Caribbean festival mm-hmm. which has been celebrated in Santiago since, I think, the 70s. Mm-hmm. And many Jamaican people come here to this festival, which is held between the 3rd and the 9th of July every year. And this year is dedicated to Haiti. But it's not only Jamaica, it is also Barbados, it is Trinidad and Tobago, you know? So, and in my research, I could throw light on the fact that indeed there are many nonverbal differences between Jamaicans and Cubans that can hamper their communication. Many, at times, Jamaican girls say to have been outraged mm-hmm. by the way Cuban men on the Cuban streets call them mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, or make a pass at them. And it is also, or there is also the matter of emblems. Mm-hmm. Emblems are nonverbal acts which are known by everybody who is part of a speech community. Mm-hmm. And there are many emblems that they have coinciding with the ones we have. But there are many emblems that they have that are so different. Mm-hmm. And that, for example, if you express nonverbally with a Jamaican person attaching to our emblem the meaning that you think it has in their culture, there can be a barrier mm-hmm. in communication between us. So this is where my research is going. This is where it is moving, to throw light on this fact that there are many nonverbal differences that can affect our communication. And I can also intend to do it, is I did it, but I am trying to enlarge it, a glossary of emblems, you know, a glossary of Jamaican emblems, so we can know mm-hmm. what coincides and what doesn't coincide.
Well, thank you very much. I really greatly appreciate having the opportunity to speak with you today, and as well as over the past number of weeks interacting with you and your students in various ways. It's been really quite an incredible experience. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. On my own behalf and on my students' behalf, and you told me yesterday that tomorrow there is a farewell party, yeah. And if you allow me, as a token of gratitude, I would like to give a speech tomorrow. But for the party begins on my own behalf and on my students' behalf. Thank you very much.